Welcome to Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, February 16th, 2025. Chocolate is in the news. This is the season of eating chocolate, and a feature that appeared 2 years ago in February clues us in on the pluses and minuses of chocolate, dark chocolate in particular. This feature is from the February 2023 issue of CSA News, Crops Science, Soil Science, and Agronomy. The Bitter and the Sweet, Curbing Cadmium in Chocolate and Other Crops, by Kristen Coyne. Warm up the cocoa and unwrap the kisses. It's chocolate season again, with two of the year's three biggest chocolate holidays, Valentine's Day, yesterday, and Easter, pending upon us. From heart-shaped confections to marshmallow-stuffed bunnies and from nut-filled nuggets to gold-dusted truffles, sweet treats for indulging and sharing abound. One ingredient they all have in common, of course, is cocoa from the cacao plant. A binomial that fittingly translates into food of the gods. But they also share a less heavenly component, if only in trace amounts, the element cadmium. Cadmium, a metal toxic to humans if absorbed in high enough quantities, is found in all soils. So virtually anything you pop in your mouth is likely to have at least a tiny bit of cadmium in it, according to SSSA and ASA fellow Rufus Cheney, a retired USDA research specialist who has studied metals in soils, soil amendments, plants, and livestock-based foods for decades. Every food contains cadmium, he says. Cheney does not mean to alarm you. Rice is the only food demonstrated to cause human cadmium disease, he stresses, and then only under unusual circumstances, we'll get to later. Nonetheless, concerns over cadmium in food persist and cut across many sectors, including plant breeding, food production, nutrition, international trade, soil science, economics, agronomy, and food safety. The food industry has taken note. They are calling and asking, where can I get wheat potatoes, for example, with low concentrations of cadmium, says ASA and SSSA member Daniel Strawn, a University of Idaho soil chemist who specializes in trace metals in the environment. They know what they want. Perhaps for no food are these intersections as complex as they are for chocolate, for multiple reasons. One is cacao's tendency to take up cadmium, although, as Strawn notes, it's not like people are eating large amounts of chocolate every day as part of their diet. The beans do, ounce for ounce, have more cadmium than many other foods. Secondly, as the world's biggest cacao consumer, Europe has a strong voice in the cadmium conversation, and apart from California's, their limits are the world's toughest, particularly for the grade of cacao that ends up in little mouths. Another reason, chocolate is big business. Americans alone spent more than $21 billion on chocolate in 2021, a sum expected to climb to more than $25 billion by next year, 2026, according to a report by the National Confectioners Association. The association also reports that consumption of fine chocolate, which has higher levels of cacao, is up significantly. Finally, it's not all sweet talk in the world of chocolate. Some regulatory bodies are at odds over where to draw the line on cadmium limits, and countries with high cadmium soils are pitted against those with low cadmium soils. These clashes play out as consumers grow increasingly anxious over dietary dangers. In one 2020 global survey, respondents reported being more concerned about food safety than health or the environment. Toward the end of this story, we'll delve deeper into some recent science on chocolate and cadmium. We are saving that, you might say, for dessert. First, we'll look at cadmium in food more broadly, with some helpings of rice, wheat, and spinach along the way. And we'll see what scientists are learning about reducing cadmium levels in crops. Unfurling on U.S. wheat fields, in Asian rice paddies, and across the Amazon basin, it's a tale shaped by many forces, of which science is one. From soil to plant, nature's little wedding crashers. All soils contain cadmium. That doesn't make it a problem. Most of our farming soils aren't contaminated, Strawn stresses. They just have cadmium there naturally. It's part of what's in all soils. But shale-derived soils tend to be higher in cadmium. Some industrial processes release cadmium into the environment, and the biosolids, manures, and fertilizers that boost soil health and yields can also contribute cadmium stowaways. Whether introduced by us or by Mother Nature, concentrations of cadmium in soil vary widely, from 0.01 to 300 milligram, Cheney says, and that is milligrams per kilogram. In California, parts of the Salinas Valley have higher levels of cadmium than elsewhere in the state. Cacao growers in parts of South America plant in higher cadmium soils than their African counterparts. Wheat farmers across Idaho and other wheat-growing regions also encounter different levels. So how does that cadmium get from soil to plant? After all, while plants need zinc, iron, and other elements, they have no known need for cadmium. As it turns out, the unwelcome metal acts like a wedding crasher, skulking through the door intended for invited guests only. The zinc uptake is through the same transporter as cadmium in all plants except rice, explains SSSA and ASA fellow Ganga Hediar Achchi, a Kansas City University, KSU, soil chemist who is an expert in trace metals and nutrient chemistry in soils. In rice, cadmium is taken up by the manganese transporter. But cadmium only manages this trick when it sufficiently outnumbers zinc, an uncommon scenario. In most soils, zinc is more than 100 times higher than cadmium, and the zinc inhibits cadmium uptake, Cheney explains. How much of the cadmium in soil ends up in plants depends on several factors, including the crop, the cultivar, soil properties, and management practices. In the Salinas Valley in California, for example, farmers apply zinc to outcompete cadmium for crops like spinach, which tends to take up more cadmium than other produce. In addition, organic matter can serve as a kind of bouncer for would-be cadmium wedding crashers, forming bonds with those ions before they have a chance to sneak into the plant. In areas of Ecuador and Colombia, some farmers contend with not only high cadmium, but also acidic soils, which make cadmium more phytoavailable. It makes the cadmium flow right into the beans, Cheney says. In Idaho, Strawn recently looked at uptake of cadmium in common wheat across different regions and cultivars. As he reported recently in AgroSystems, Geosciences, and Environment, almost all the wheat tested was within the 0.2 megagrams per kilogram cadmium limit for adults set by the World Health Organization, WHO, and the United Nations, UN. In addition, wheat grown in lower cadmium soils had less cadmium, and some cultivars proved better at excluding cadmium. About one-third of the samples had levels low enough, below 0.04 megagrams per kilogram, to meet the European Union's, EU, strict thresholds for baby food. Strawn dubbed these samples ultra-low cadmium wheat and says they could command a higher price. The food companies are looking for this ultra-low cadmium if you can produce it, he says. You should get a premium for that crop because it qualifies for a special food production class, in this case for baby food. From plants to people, the case for cadmium caps. Not all the cadmium that creeps into a crop will be absorbed by the person who eats it. What's phytoavailable isn't necessarily bioavailable. Two key factors play a role here. the other nutrients present in the food, and the other nutrients present in the body eating the food. The iron in wheat, for example, is fairly bioavailable, which reduces the body's absorption of the cadmium from that wheat. Hetiarach Chichi explains, rice, which is low in iron, zinc, and calcium for human health, is a different story. You don't have that protection at the same level from cadmium in rice, she says. People who subsist largely on rice suffer a double whammy. They eat a lot of crop that tends to accumulate cadmium, and their bodies lack important nutrients that could help protect them. Subsistence rice diets are so low in zinc and iron and cadmium that they can absorb 10 times more cadmium than a person on a normal diet, Cheney says. Iron deficiencies are particularly problematic, he adds, because cadmium is taken up on the iron transporter in the intestine. This explains in part findings of a recent report from the WHO and the UN showing that Chinese children ages 4 to 11 have the highest levels of cadmium intake among children in the world. Cadmium, in short, is complicated, which has led to a multitude of regulations that are both complex and controversial. They are expressed in different ways, including provisional tolerable monthly intake, or PTMI, health-based guidance values, micrograms per kilogram of body weight, maximum allowable daily levels, or MADL, and micrograms per kilogram per day, or per serving. Some regulations cap amounts of cadmium in specific foods, while others limit how much should be consumed within a time period. It can be very confusing, Strawn says. In the U.S., for example, the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, US EPA, and the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry have various recommendations for what is safe to consume. In addition, the FDA in 2021 launched its Closer to Zero campaign, which seeks to reduce arsenic, lead, cadmium, and mercury in foods eaten by babies and young children to as low as possible. California is its own special case due to Proposition 65, which requires businesses to warn consumers when their products contain harmful chemicals. The state's MADL for cadmium exposure for all food is a high threshold. That threshold has led to spinach recalls, and a 2021 report by an environmental watchdog found multiple instances of spinach exceeding those amounts. In contrast to the more fragmented U.S. approach, the WHO-UN has drawn up very specific cadmium guidelines. The European Union also has its own regulations, and the two sets don't always agree. Together, the World Health Organization and the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization wrote the book on food safety. Dating to the early 1960s and regularly revised, the Codex Alimentarius is a list of voluntary standards agreed upon by member states. These include a recommended limit of 58.3 per day, twice as high as the EU's 25 per day limit, and almost 15 times higher than the California limit. The codex also includes limits for specific foods like legumes, 0.1 milligrams per kilogram, wheat, 0.2 milligrams per kilogram, and rice, 0.4 milligrams per kilogram. Recently, the organization proposed revisiting its limits for cadmium in chocolate to 0.3 milligrams per kilogram for chocolate containing up to 30% cocoa solids and 0.7 milligrams per kilogram for chocolate containing 30 to 50% cocoa solids. The proposal has highlighted how controversial these caps can be. While the EU criticized the limits as too lax, the EU's are much lower. Ecuador strongly advocated for them. But given Europe's huge appetite for chocolate, its limits often prevail. These are large food producers, Strawn notes. They don't change the recipe for every country, and so if the European Union regulations require wheat to be below 0.2 milligrams per kilogram in total cadmium, most large producers are going to respond to that, for their whole product line. Cheney argues that for all their PTMIs and MADLs, policymakers miss the mark by counting all the cadmium in a food when less than half of it, at most, is actually bioavailable. According to several studies, there is little correlation between how much high-cadmium foods people eat, except for rice, and levels of cadmium in their blood, assuming healthy diets, he says. Hetiarchi agrees. I think it's time for us to look not just at concentration, she says. We need to look at the speciation as well, because that's going to determine whether that cadmium or that lead or arsenic is going to dissolve and be able to be absorbed by a human body when it is passing through it. As it stands, cacao grown in some high cadmium soil areas of South America doesn't meet the stricter regulations. Scientists like SSSA member Eduardo Gutierrez are trying to learn what can be done about that. Cadmium in the cradle of cacao. For Gutierrez, chocolate isn't just delicious, it's personal. A native of Ecuador, he learned all about the crop on his grandfather's 60-acre cacao farm, how to open the pods, remove the seeds, and savor them. They have an incredible flavor, says Gutierrez, who prefers an Ecuadorian brand of fine chocolate that features a passion fruit flavor, his favorite. It's no surprise the country produces some of the world's best chocolate. After all, it's the cradle of cacao. The earliest known use of cacao occurred there more than 5,000 years ago, and the crop was first cultivated in the area, according to studies. Today, it's one of the country's top crops, with more than 327,000 metric tons harvested in 2020. We know how to produce good quality cacao. We know how to produce a big amount of cacao, Gutierrez says. But we have a big problem. We have some areas with an elevated concentration of cadmium in the cacao. Gutierrez has taken on that problem. A PhD candidate in Hetiarchi's soil chemistry lab at KSU, he recently took a deep dive into how compost can curb cadmium uptake in the plant. For the experiment, he and his colleagues surface-applied compost in different amounts to soils on four Ecuadorian cacao farms. After a year, they examined soil and plant leaves and bean samples to shed light on how that compost impacted soil chemistry and cadmium uptake. In the journal Frontiers in Environmental Science and at the Society's 2022 annual meeting, Gutierrez reported the results. As expected, the compost reduced cadmium levels pretty much across the board, but it worked better under certain conditions. The team divided up the cadmium in the soil samples by the compound the metal had bound to, and then compared these to the cadmium in the cacao seeds and leaves. Some extractants, they confirmed, like potassium nitrate, tend to release cadmium proportional to the plant, while others, such as nitric acid, dissolve most of the total cadmium in the soil. The researchers also zoomed in on humic and fulvic acids in the soils. Their data suggested that in soils with more fulvic acid, less cadmium was taken up by plants. For example, the cadmium extracted by nitric acid showed a significant positive correlation to the cadmium associated with fulvic acid, while both fractions showed a significant negative correlation with cadmium in cacao tissues. By adding the compost, we were able to increase fulvic acid much more, so that increase was high enough to negate any kind of negative effect due to enhanced solubility, explains Hetiarchi, a co-author on the paper. As a net effect, we saw reduction in cadmium in leaf and cadmium in beans. The data, Gutierrez says, suggest that better, more mature compost with higher fulvic and humic acid contents may be key for lowering plant cadmium, with fulvic acid playing a particularly influential role. But applying amendments of any kind in cacao orchards is challenging, given those shallow roots. In fact, in a 2022 report coming out of California, a team of experts expressed doubt that composting could help high cadmium cacao regions anytime soon due to cost and availability of quality composts in rural areas. The report, compiled after tests found cadmium in excess of state limits in products sold there, concludes. The report, compiled after tests found cadmium in excess of state limits in products sold there, concludes that many soil amendment recommendations have not been shown to be effective at scale, and that it's unclear how they would be implemented if they ever were found to be effective. Cheney, one of the four experts behind the report, doesn't question that the right amendments can curb cadmium in cacao. He notes that a Trinidadian colleague, after applying a slurry of zinc or hydrated lime to soil in a cacao orchard via a backpack-mounted pump, significantly reduced cadmium in the plant. But such a labor-intensive process, he says, is impractical. For that reason, the California report advises chocolate producers who need to meet strict limits to avoid cacao grown in high cadmium regions altogether, especially for fine chocolate with its higher cacao content. The recommendation doesn't distinguish the 60% of the chocolate liqueur from Latin America and the Caribbean that exceeds the trigger from the 40% that doesn't. Industry just wants low-cadmium chocolate beans, Cheney explains. They have the power to analyze and decide where they're going to purchase. Given existing cadmium limits, there are no quick fixes, Cheney says. But he adds there are promising long-term approaches. Plant breeders to the rescue. A few decades ago, another cadmium conundrum was playing out far from the Amazon basin. In the northern Great Plains, nearly all U.S. durum wheat had doubled the cadmium concentration of common wheat. Then, as Cheney recounts in a 2008 paper, a Canadian breeder identified a part of the plant's genome that carried the trait associated with grain cadmium. The gene that was eventually pinpointed, HMA3, controls the pumping of cadmium into the vacuoles of root cells, acting like a tiny metal detector that keeps cadmium out of the plant, leaves, and grain. The discovery led to the development of low-cadmium durum wheat cultivars in Canada and the U.S. Today, most U.S. and Canadian durum wheat has the low-cadmium gene, Cheney says. The approach has led to similar efforts for other crops. Asian scientists are tweaking this gene in rice so that it keeps on pumping, according to Cheney. There's no cheaper way for society in general to reduce cadmium in food than to use overexpression of HMA3, he says. Making changes to the rootstock genotype could offer the best genetic approach for cacao, he adds. You could make all future chocolate trees have very low cadmium, Cheney says. That's a good solution that could be achieved in 20 years. In the meantime, scientists, farmers, and food producers continue to experiment with solutions, agronomic and otherwise. These include exploring new, non-edible uses for cacao, for example, or mixing high and low cadmium batches of cacao to create products that still meet cadmium limits. Although solutions may also originate in food production, marketing, policymaking, and other sectors, Hetiarachchi hopes that science will always come first, particularly as some push for ever lower limits. I do not necessarily support very stringent regulations and assuming low is always better, she says. Her latest project tests if soil amendments can lower blood lead levels in Kansas City children. I think regulatory bodies need to consider the science and then strongly consider, do we need to go this low? And how practical is it to achieve that? It doesn't mean that we should not try to minimize it, she continues. By all means, I spend quite a lot of my time doing research to minimize soil contaminant transfer. But I think we need to look at the practical aspect as well. This feature, the bitter and the sweet, curbing cadmium in chocolate and other crops, appeared in the February 2023 issue of CSA News, Crops Science, Soil Science, and Agronomy. And this concern for cadmium in chocolate continues, generating many additional studies. A news release from Tulane University, dated June 5, 2024, summarizes the research that has taken place there. A dark side to dark chocolate? New study finds very minimal risk for kids from metals in chocolates. Chocolate lovers may have been alarmed by a 2023 Consumer Reports finding that some dark chocolate brands could contain harmful levels of lead and cadmium. However, a new study by Tulane University, which was published in Food Research International, has found that dark chocolate poses no adverse risk for adults and contains nutritionally beneficial levels of essential minerals. The study sampled 155 dark and milk chocolates from various global brands sold in the U.S. and tested for the presence of 16 heavy metals, ranging from the toxic, lead and cadmium, to the essential, copper, iron, and zinc. The study then modeled the risk of eating 1 ounce of the chocolates per day, which is equivalent to consuming more than 2 whole chocolate bars a week. The research found that only one brand of dark chocolate exceeded the international limit for cadmium in bars containing more than 50% cacao, which is 800 micrograms per kilogram, and only 4 dark chocolate bars had cadmium levels that could pose a risk to children weighing 33 pounds or less, the average weight of a 3-year-old in the U.S. For adults, there is no adverse health risk from eating dark chocolate, and although there is a slight risk for children in 4 of the 155 chocolate bars sampled, it is not common to see a 3-year-old regularly consume more than 2 bars of chocolate per week, said lead author Tewodros Gadebo, assistant professor of environmental health sciences at Tulane University School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine. What we've found is that it's quite safe to consume dark and milk chocolates. When tested for lead, 2 chocolate bars contained levels above California's interim standards for dark chocolates, but neither was determined to pose adverse risks to children or adults. While 2 previous studies in the U.S. examined the presence of lead and cadmium in chocolate, this study employed the largest sample size, expanded the scope of testing to 16 metals, and included a risk assessment of toxic metals that accounted for the nutritional contribution of essential minerals. The dark chocolates were found to contain high levels of nutrients such as copper, iron, manganese, magnesium, and zinc, and several of the chocolates sampled provided more than 50% of the daily requirement for children and adults, Godebo said. Not only is it packed with these essential minerals, but they can potentially reduce the absorption of toxic metals in the intestine, since these metals compete for the same site, he said. The study found that much of the lead in chocolate comes from the post-harvest processing, whereas cadmium comes from the soil and passes through the plant and into the cacao bean. The researchers also sorted the chocolates geographically and found that dark chocolates from South America had higher levels of cadmium and lead than chocolates from Asia and West Africa, the latter of which is a primary source of dark chocolate for the United States. But even for chocolates from South America, we found there is no adverse risk in eating 1 ounce per day, Godebo said. And this updated information comes from Tulane University's press release dated June 5, 2024. Tulane University is a private college in New Orleans, Louisiana. And speaking of food, on meds, you may be able to eat grapefruit again someday. Scientists have identified a gene that causes production of a substance in some citrus that interferes with many medications. By Veronique Greenwood, posted on January 10, 2025, a New York Times trilobite. You may be among the millions of people who have seen a surprisingly specific warning like this on the labels of drugs you take. Avoid eating grapefruit or drinking grapefruit juice while using this medication. Such warnings are issued for dozens of substances, including docetaxel, a cancer drug, erythromycin, an antibiotic, and some statins, the cholesterol-lowering drugs, prescribed to more than a third of American adults over 40. The problem is a set of molecules, furanocoumarins. High levels of furanocoumarins interfere with human liver enzymes, among other processes. In their presence, medications can build up to unhealthy levels in the body, and grapefruits and some related citrus fruits are full of them. But there is no such warning for other kinds of citrus, such as mandarins and other oranges. Citrus researchers at the Volcani Center in Israel reported Wednesday in the journal The New Phytologist that by crossing mandarins and grapefruit, they've uncovered genes that produce furanocoumarins in some citrus fruits. It's a finding that opens the possibility of creating grapefruit that doesn't require a warning label. Scientists have worked out the compound's structures and pieced together a basic flowchart of how they made of how they are made years ago, said Yoram Ayal, a professor at the Volcani Center. But the precise identities of enzymes catalyzing the process, the proteins that snip off a branch here or add a piece there, remained mysterious. He and his colleagues knew that one way to identify them was to breed citrus high in furanocoumarins with those without. If the offspring of such a cross had varying levels of the substances, it should be possible, by digging into their genetics, to pinpoint the genes for the proteins. We were afraid to approach it because it's very time-consuming and it takes many years, he said, noting how involved it can be to grow new trees from seeds and assess their genetics. But finally, we decided we have to dive in. When they examined the offspring of a mandarin and a grapefruit, the researchers saw something remarkable. 50% of the young plants had high levels of furanocoumarins and 50% had none. That particular signature meant something very specific in terms of how the ability to make these substances is inherited. We saw there was only one gene that could have controlled it, said Livnat Goldenberg, a Volcani Center researcher who is the lead author of the new study. The researchers soon identified the gene controlling the production of furanocoumarins in leaves and fruit, which produces an enzyme called 2-oxoglutarate-dependent dioxygenase, or 2-OGD for short. Mandarins, it turns out, have a mutated form of this gene that keeps the enzyme from functioning properly. This version cropped up in all the mandarin and orange varieties the researchers checked, explaining why they do not cause the same problems as grapefruit in people taking prescription medications. In these plants, furanocoumarin production is paused. With gene editing technology, it should be possible to alter the gene in grapefruit as well, Dr. Ayal suggests. The team at the Volcani Center is now exploring that project. Looking at how widespread this mutated version is in mandarins and some other citrus, the scientists speculate that some gene nearby on the genome must play an important role in a highly prized trait. A long-ago citrus breeder, selecting for some unknown quality, must have unwittingly spread this furanocoumarin-busting version of the gene to an ancestor of modern varieties of mandarins and oranges. All these years later, that person's work is coming to light, under the gaze of geneticists, who may someday put grapefruit back on the menu. And that's the New York Times Trilobite on meds. You may be able to eat grapefruit again someday. Scientists have identified a gene that causes production of a substance in some citrus that interferes with many medications. Easter and Easter egg hunts may be 2 months away, but it's not too early to talk about how to boil an egg. A New York Times Trilobite posted on February 6, 2025, written by Alexander Nazarian. How to boil an egg? Scientists claim to have cracked the recipe. Their new method takes 32 minutes. A colleague approached Ernesto Di Maio, a materials scientist in Naples, Italy, and an expert in plastic foams, with a blunt suggestion. You should do something cooler. The colleague had a project in mind, Dr. Di Maio recalled. He wanted a perfectly boiled egg. The task was harder than it might seem, as many home cooks know. The yolk and the egg white, or albumin, have different chemical compositions, which call for different heating temperatures. Dr. Di Maio and his colleagues also welcomed the chance to one-up the Michelin star chef Carlo Crocco, an egg evangelist who charges $52 for an egg yolk dish at his restaurant in Milan. The scientists devised a way of cooking an egg that requires no special culinary skill or fancy gadgets. It took about 300 eggs, though the researchers didn't eat all of them, said Pellegrino Musto, a polymer expert at the National Research Council of Italy. The researchers said their method, published a few weeks ago, preserves the distinct textures of the egg as well as its nutritional value. The two parts of the egg require different cooking temperatures because they have different chemical components. The albumin is mainly composed of water and proteins, said Emilia Di Lorenzo, a graduate student in Dr. Di Maio's lab at the University of Naples, Federico II, who recently published a paper on foaming pizza. Yolk, on the other hand, is much richer in nutrients. Hard boiling an egg is a popular approach that calls for at least 10 minutes of immersion in boiling water. That is long enough for the yolk to be thoroughly cooked, but it's also plenty of time for the albumin's proteins to unfold and clump, expelling water molecules as they become heated. The approach can also create a green ring around the yolk, which indicates the presence of smelly ferrous sulfide. Many times people say that they don't like the rubberiness of the egg white or the graininess of the yolk in a hard-boiled egg, said Nelson Serrano Barri, a chef and the director of innovation at the American Egg Board, the egg industry's main trade association, which has lately been dealing with soaring prices and worries about the bird flu. A soft boil, on the other hand, needs a much shorter cooking period. That keeps the albumin from turning hard, but may also keep the yolk too soft. Ms. Di Lorenzo explained that the yolk is rich in lipids, which, when heated, become more fluid. Though some people prefer a runny yolk, others find it revolting. A third method, known as sous vide, cooks an egg for an hour in a water bath of 150 degrees Fahrenheit. That's the ideal temperature for the yolk, but the prolonged exposure is less optimal for the albumin because the water is not hot enough to denature its proteins. Ms. Di Lorenzo was blunt about the sous vide approach. It's runny. I am not a big fan. The scientist's new method, derived with the help of fluid dynamics software, calls for alternating between boiling and lukewarm water. The egg gets 2 minutes in 212-degree water, followed by 2 minutes at 86 degrees, with the cycle repeated 8 times. Dr. Di Maio explained that the average temperature of the two immersions, 150 degrees, is ideal for the yolk, while the hotter bath is sufficient to cook the albumin. The very key of our method is to have a well-cooked albumin without wasting the yolk, Dr. Di Maio said. Relative to the other methods, the periodic baths did a better job of preserving the egg's nutrients, the study found. The authors noted a higher concentration of polyphenols, compounds that protect against DNA damage. "It's probably brilliant, but who is the method for?" asked Deb Perelman, who runs the popular Smitten Kitchen blog. "For home cooking, there's always a necessary balance of perfect versus a reasonable effort." Her preferred foolproof method involves a long ice bath after the egg is cooked. In a recipe for the New York Times, J. Kenji Lopez-Alt proposed steaming the egg in a single inch of water. "It's a matter of taste," Ms. DiLorenzo said. "If science is universal, food is deeply personal. Some people even eat raw eggs." There's one big drawback to the new Italian technique. It's more difficult to peel the periodic egg because everything is softer, Dr. Di Maio said. But Mr. Serrano Bari said that the egg board was on the case. "We are running a study to figure out that," he said. "I could have an answer for you in the coming months." This New York Times trilobite, published on February 6, 2025, reports on the ongoing search to answer the question, how to boil an egg. And speaking of eggs, this next New York Times trilobite explains that snakeskin isn't just a fashion statement for birds. A museum curator with a ladder showed that birds that build cavity-style nests are able to protect their eggs with the skin shed by snakes. Written by Kate Golombievsky, this was originally published on January 25th and updated on February 3rd, 2025. In 1889, the naturalist Alan Octavian Hume wrote that he was puzzled by macabre decorations he observed in many birds' nests, strips of dried snakeskin. "Are birds superstitious, I wonder? Do they believe in charms?" he wrote in The Nests and Eggs of Indian Birds. If not, why were so many birds using pieces of snakeskin to adorn their nests? Hume and several of his contemporaries had a hypothesis. The snakeskin scared away predators. A new study suggests that they were onto something. After analyzing century-old records of birds' nests and observing over 140 nests with and without snakeskin, researchers reported in January in the American Naturalist that in some types of nests, the presence of snakeskin greatly reduced the risk that predators would take the eggs. All reptiles shed patches of dead skin as they grow, but snakes shed skins off their entire bodies in one big piece. However, finding a snakeskin in the wild can be tricky, said Vanya Rower, a curator at the Cornell University Museum of Vertebrates and an author of the study. "This scarcity of snakeskin makes it all the more remarkable that so many birds use it in their nests. How in the world are they finding it? And why do they invest all that time to bring it back to their nests?" Dr. Rower said. He delved into digitized historical records of birds' nesting behavior, including handwritten observations of nests from over a century ago. He and his colleagues determined that cavity nesters, birds that build their nests in holes in structures like trees and cliffs, are 6.5 times more likely to incorporate snakeskin into their nests than species that create more classic cup-shaped nests. Based on this information, Dr. Rower devised a series of experiments to try and understand what the benefits of shed snakeskin might be. He surveyed the microbes and larger parasites in nests, with and without snakeskin, to see if the skin warded off critters like fleas and mites or reduced the nest's harmful microbes. There didn't seem to be any correlations. The other idea that we looked at was a nest predation idea, Dr. Rower said. In a forested area called Monkey Run near the Cornell campus in Ithaca, New York, Dr. Rower put quail eggs into 65 nest boxes, which are like cavity nests, and 80 empty robin's nests, which are open cup nests. He added snakeskin to half of the nests and spent the next several weeks checking on them with a ladder. "My wife nicknamed me Ladderman," he said. During his stint as Ladderman, Dr. Rohrer found something surprising. While the snakeskin didn't seem to make much difference to the safety of the eggs in the open cup nests, the scaly scraps made a big difference in the nest boxes. The cavity nests with snakeskin had a much higher chance of surviving a 14-day incubation period compared to a cavity nest without snakeskin, he said. In particular, snakeskin seemed to deter small mammals like mice, which are known to take eggs. This discovery suggested additional questions. What is scary about snakeskin? Is it the smell of snakeskin? Is it the sight of snakeskin to these small mammals? Dr. Rohrer said. Ross Crates, an ecologist at the Australian National University, who was not involved in the study, noted that other research had shown that some birds hissed to ward off predators to their nests. Pretending that there's a snake in the nest in some way is beneficial for these small, hole-nesting birds that have less capacity to actually physically defend the nest against larger, mostly mammalian predators, Dr. Crates suggested. Dr. Rohrer said that nests had been overlooked in scientific research, in part because they can be difficult to observe and study. Digitized data sets like the ones he and his colleagues used are helping researchers to make discoveries. We are only now just starting to really look at some of the unique materials in birds' nests, he said. And this New York Times trilobite, posted on February 3, 2025, tells us that snakeskin isn't just a fashion statement for birds. A museum curator with a ladder showed that birds that build cavity-style nests are able to protect their eggs with the skin shed by snakes. And now we turn to the latest issue of Science News, February 2025, in the department Earth. West coasters, watch out. An undersea volcano may soon erupt near Oregon. By Rachel Berkowitz. An undersea volcano is likely to erupt sometime in 2025. This much advance notice is a big deal, because forecasting eruptions more than hours ahead is pretty unique, says geophysicist William Chadwick. About 470 kilometers off the Oregon coast, and over a kilometer beneath the waves, a volcano known as Axial Seamount ticks all the boxes that hint at imminent activity, Chadwick and his colleagues found and reported at a meeting of the American Geophysical Union that was held in Washington, D.C. in December 2024. For the last decade, a suite of devices have been monitoring Axial's every action, rumbling, shaking, swelling, tilting, and delivering real-time data with a seafloor cable. It's the most well-instrumented submarine volcano on the planet, says Mark Zumberg, a geophysicist at Scripps Institution of Oceanography in La Jolla, California, who was not involved in this work. In November of 2024, a particular milestone caught Chadwick's eye. Axial's surface had ballooned to nearly the same height as it had before the volcano last erupted in 2015. Ballooning is a sign that magma has accumulated underground and is building pressure. The 2015 swelling allowed his team to predict that year's eruption. Our best forecasting success, says Chadwick of Oregon State University's Hatfield Marine Science Center in Newport. The recent swelling, along with increased seismic activity that indicates moving magma, has led the researchers to narrow in on the next one. Axial scientists also have a new tool for estimating the day of magma burst that will set things off, and other researchers recently used artificial intelligence, or AI, to analyze data from earthquakes that preceded the 2015 eruption to identify exactly what patterns they should see hours ahead of the next one. If this precursory earthquake detection works, it will be a field day for volcanologists such as Rebecca Carey. Detecting early warning signals offers the exciting opportunity to deploy remotely operated vehicles to catch the eruption occurring, says Carey of the University of Tasmania in Sandy Bay, Australia. That could offer a glimpse into an eruption's effects on nearby hydrothermal systems and biological communities. For humans, volcanoes on land generally pose a larger hazard than ones underwater do. But that's not always the case. The 2022 Hunga Tonga eruption in the South Pacific Ocean triggered a tsunami that caused at least $90 million worth of damage. Generally, forecasting is difficult, Chadwick says. One disincentive for experimental forecasting on land is the risk of false alarms, which could cause unnecessary evacuations and future distrust. At Axial, he says, we don't have to worry about that. Forecasting is only possible thanks to extensive monitoring data and knowledge of how a specific volcano behaves. There's no crystal ball, says Valerio Acocella, a volcanologist at Roma Tre University in Rome. Rather, predictions are based on the expectation that when a volcano's activity reaches some threshold that it reached before, it may erupt. Geophysicist Michael Poland of the U.S. Geological Survey's Cascades Volcano Observatory in Vancouver, Washington, agrees. Because most of today's efforts rely on recognizing patterns, he says, there's always the risk that a volcano will follow a pattern that we haven't seen before and do something unexpected. Both Poland and Acocella hope that forecasts will evolve to be based on the physics and chemistry of the magma systems that underlie a volcano. Until then, scientists will learn what they can from any successes, and Axial is a good place to try, Acocella says. It has relatively frequent eruptions, and each one is an opportunity to test ideas. That regular behavior makes Axial a very promising volcano, he says. We need these ideal cases to understand how volcanoes work. And this update on undersea volcanoes near Oregon, and one that will soon erupt, appears in the new February 2025 issue of Science News. And in this same issue of Science News, a tidbit from the Department of Paleontology. New clues emerge in Kangaroo Whodunit by Carolyn Gramling. The prime suspects behind the demise of most of Australia's kangaroo species by 40,000 years ago are thought to be the arrival of human hunters and rapid changes in the climate, which may have restricted kangaroos' dietary options. But the marsupials had weathered climate shifts before, diversifying into new species with varied diets as Australia, once a lush rainforest, died out and dried out over millions of years. Paleontologist Samuel Arman of the Museum and Art Gallery of Northern Territory in Alice Springs, Australia, and colleagues analyzed wear on the teeth of 937 kangaroos representing 12 ancient species and 16 modern ones. The wear patterns point to what the creatures ate. The analyses reveal the ancient marsupials weren't picky eaters as once thought, the team reported in the journal Science. So when it came to climate-driven changes in food availability, the animals might have rolled with the punches. Modern kangaroos tend to graze on soft grasses or have a mixed diet of grasses and tougher plants. Previous cranial analyses suggested many ancient species were pickier, but the new study calls that into question, lending support to the hypothesis that hunting, not dietary restrictions, was the main culprit behind their demise. This tidbit from the new issue of Science News, February 2025, written by Carolyn Gramling. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next week.